Support for Sound Effect comes from WSECU. Local to Washington, WSECU is a credit union founded in public service. Today, WSECU serves more than 260,000 members. More information is available at wsecu.org. WSECU, serving Washington since 1957.
After liftoff, after 10 minutes, I could feel like I'm floating. Even if I was strapped really tight, but still I can feel like, oh my God, my body was much slighter than before, and then I'm floating inside of my strap.
Hey, I'm Gabriel Spitzer. This is Sound Effect, and this is from my conversation with Soyun Yi. She lives in Puyallup, but before that, she was the first and only South Korean astronaut. She traveled to space in 2008.
Even during the training, always medical doctor told me you are very, very vulnerable with the motion sickness. So doctor told me, please don't try to look through the window. If you look through the window, you have extremely hard motion sickness. So right beside my head, there's a window. So if I open the shutter, I can see through the window anytime. It's really tempting. Oh, I really want to see, but doctor told me shouldn't. Should I open or not? But finally, after getting to the orbit, and then everything's stable, and then I decide, even if I will have a motion sickness, I cannot miss this moment. And then open the shutter, look through the window. There was a beautiful Earth down there. It's a real Earth.
And did you get sick?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I got sick. I throw up every 10 minutes. Still, I remember. It's really awesome.
That kind of encapsulates the story of space exploration. You know, vertigo, anxiety, danger, all overcome by humans' insatiable curiosity. This episode of our show is part of the Destination Moon Pod Crawl, which marks 50 years since the Apollo 11 astronauts first crossed the void and set foot on the moon. When you're done, I hope you'll check out some of our partners, including Radiotopia's The Truth, Stuff You Missed in History Class, Flight Deck, and GeekWire. Today on Sound Effect, our theme is One Giant Leap, people who take their inspiration from the exploration of space. We'll start with astrophysicist Julianne Del Canton. Now, a lot of us work with tools, and you tend to develop a special relationship with your gear, whether it's a trumpet or a nail gun or a piece of software. Well, Del Canton has always had a soft spot for the Hubble telescope. She's now helping to envision what a successor to Hubble will look like. I caught her at her University of Washington office, and she told me just how large Hubble loomed when she was getting her start.
I actually met up with one of my professors from back then who described something I said that I have no recollection of sending, but he brought in a picture of the Hubble Deep Field, which had just been taken. And he describes me looking at it and then despairingly saying, "We're never going to understand that," because it was such a mess compared to anything that we had ever seen before. And what's amazing is close to 20 years on now, we actually really do understand quite a bit of that, what looked initially like a tremendous mess. It's a testament to what the new technology brings. You see things in a different way, and at first you have no idea what to make of them. And then as time goes on, you start to figure it out.
So the Hubble is in its sunset, and the successor to the Hubble is about to launch in a few years now, but you're working two steps ahead on the Hubble's grandchild, right? What would that project be, the proposal that you and a number of other astronomers and physicists have put forward?
So it's an interesting exercise because you have to be thinking about what science is still going to be compelling several decades out. So right now the Hubble Space Telescope is operating and it's only 2.5 meters across. Like, I mean, you really could hug it. It's not very large.
Would you like to?
I wouldn't want to get it dirty. Okay. If it came down safely, I would give it a gentle pat. But we're looking ahead. For now, we're calling it the High Definition Space Telescope. It would be a mirror that was around 12 meters across. With a telescope this large, the precision with which you can view things in space goes way, way up. One of our team members worked out that it was almost identical to the increase in resolution from an old tube television, the ones that people can't even give away on the side of the street anymore, to an ultra-high definition screen today.
What are some of the things that the high-definition space telescope would be able to do at that resolution that Hubble cannot?
Right now, over the past decade or so, there's been a huge revolutionary explosion in the field of what we call exoplanets, planets around other stars. It turns out that having a planetary system is very, very common. And we'd certainly hope that that would be the case. There have been ideas to look for exoplanets that go back, you know, 50, 60, 70 years. So this idea has been out there for a really long time. But the technology advanced to the point where people could actually start finding the evidence for exoplanets. And I remember probably 20, maybe 15 years ago, seeing a talk by somebody who was talking about what the atmospheres of extrasolar planets might be like. What would the atmosphere be like if you had a different kind of star? And I remember seeing this talk and thinking that was just so far out there. Why would you be interested in even studying this? I'm a late adopter in all things. I absolutely did not have the vision to recognize. I called this one completely wrong, because this was, it turns out to be incredibly forward-looking in terms of something to actually do. And people are looking at what might life be like around some of these planets. You know, how might something like photosynthesis differ if you have a very different kind of cloud cover or a very different kind of star? Then there's that next level of maybe we can actually search some of these planets for what we call biosignature gases. And the idea is that there are certain features that indicate the presence of molecules that really shouldn't be there if there's no biological shaping of the atmosphere. And maybe find signs of life, right? That would be really exciting. I go back and forth. That part of me feels like if the universe did something once, it absolutely certainly did it again. And so maybe forming life is actually incredibly easy, right? So part of me is very optimistic that, you know, maybe if we look at 500 different systems, then, you know, maybe we'll find dozens upon dozens of cases where we see atmospheres that have been shaped by life. But on the other hand, life is pretty spectacular. And so maybe this almost never happens, right? I mean, this is a universe of billions of stars. And so maybe it's a one in a billion shot, and that we can look at 500 different stellar systems and not find anything that indicates anything unusual has happened on any of these planets. And both of these are very interesting, right? They're deep philosophical questions. They're exciting scientific discoveries either way.
What makes them exciting for you personally, like on a gut level?
It's pretty cool, right? I mean, I don't see how you could not find this a fascinating topic. I mean, it's the kind of thing that you chat about, you know, even as a kid, right? You see movies about aliens. Are we alone? Hypothetical questions like, you know, do we have a soul? Or what is love? Right? Are we alone in the universe? That one of those questions is turning into an actual scientific field of study where you can actually stand a chance of potentially addressing that. That's pretty amazing.
So you've had the opportunity, using Hubble and other instruments, to see things that no one else has seen before. And I don't mean just with your eyes, but I mean, you know, understand what's there in spots that haven't been just blank spaces in the past. What does that feel like to get the first glimpse into a piece of nature?
Well, I know I'm supposed to say that it's awe-inspiring, but it's mostly just fun, right? So we work very, very hard to get those observations. And golly, it's really fun when it actually happens, right? I mean, it's like when you plan your vacation, right? And all year long, you're looking at the guidebooks and you're like, oh, when I go to Disneyland, I'm going to go, you know, I'm going on this ride and then I'm going to go eat here. And you're planning and you're planning and you get there. And everything you've been dreaming about is actually true. And that's fun. It's very much the same for scientists. We make these plans, we have these hopes, and then we get the data, and it's just cool.
Do you experience the, hey, I'm at Disneyland thing more often than you experience the, wow, look at what I'm a part of thing?
Yeah, I'm at Disneyland most of the time. I'm much more than the sort of, I have those moments of awe, but I have moments of just sheer enjoyment and pleasure from working on these things on a much more common basis. I think it's, you know, an analogy I've drawn for people in the past is with medicine or doctors or a surgeon, right? The human body is this absolutely amazing thing. The fact that this works at all is incredible. But, you know, you're a surgeon, you're cutting somebody open. Oh, look, I found something on his liver, right? It's a, you know, there's, you get down into this kind of more pragmatic thing. And so you wouldn't want your surgeon, every time they open you up, to be just gazing in awe at the wonders of the human body. And, you know, you would like them to get down and get to work and really enjoy the day-to-day associated with your job. And I think most scientists really enjoy the day-to-day, even as we do get larger satisfaction of, you know, participating in this great thing.
Well, Julianne Delcanton is a professor of astronomy at the University of Washington and one of the primary authors of The Call to Arms for the Next Generation Successor to Hubble Space-Based Telescope. Thanks so much, Professor Delcanton.
Thank you very much, Gabriel.
Now, another expert who loves his tools, Bob Kramer, doesn't study the stars, though. He makes knives. But I mean top shelf, world class, the kind of knives that some people will pay $10,000 for, which also happen to do a very nice job dicing onions. Bob's story is long and winding and includes a formative year as a circus clown, but the part I want to actually tell you about right now is Bob's unconventional materials. He uses homemade steel and shooting stars.
I'm really so into making steel in my shop these days. Something about it is just so seductive. You know, it's the fire, it's the tending of the coal forge, it's the smell of the coal, it's the fact that we're...
But wait, that doesn't sound appealing to a lot of people, probably. It sounds hot and smelly and hard.
Yeah, it is, but there's just something really primitive about it. It's fire, it's tool making, it's, you know, man as the tool maker. This is probably our oldest tool, a knife, right? Other than maybe a big old bone that you hit somebody over the head with. So I'm starting with basic elements. I'm starting with really pure iron. I'm diffusing carbon into them. I'm melting meteorites into it. I feel like a kid in a candy store. It's just fun.
So where do the meteorites come from? How did you get interested in that? And like, how do you even...
So the meteorite thing is, it occurs in several myths and legends and cultures. Imagine being an ancient man and it's a clear night. And then you see a shooting star, and then you hear the sonic boom of this thing coming through the atmosphere. Boom, boom. And you see it land not too far from you, right? You're going to go over and pick this thing up. Well, now that thing is magical. This is a stone that was sent from the sky. This is a thunderstone. And so when I started to get into the whole Northwest thing, First Nation people and these Northwest Tlingit daggers, it is a prominent part of those legends. And so I was just curious, like, okay, where do I get a meteorite? Well, it turns out you can buy them on eBay.
And I think people mostly think of meteorites as being rocks, but there's a lot of metal in them.
Yeah. So the iron nickel meteorites are the ones that you can actually forge into a tool. So I bought a couple, heated this thing up, put it under the hammer, and that one turns to cottage cheese. It just kind of crumbles, and so I got this hot iron nickel spilling out over the floor. But I let it cool, scooped it all up, and, you know, slowly massaged it back into a piece of steel and folded it and stretched it and folded it and incorporated some carbon into it, made a knife out of it.
It strikes me that you really have room in your personality for both the rules, the precision, the engineering and the science, but also this whimsy and wonder and fantasy.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, I hope I never lose that. I think we can be most creative when we're in a playful space. If we're just in a space of seriousness and linear thinking, then that creativity evaporates. And so to be able to create some space where you can just step into it and play and not be demanding of the time is incredibly beneficial.
Well, Bob Kramer is a master bladesmith, and he runs Kramer's Knives here in Olympia, Washington. Thanks so much for being on our show, Bob.
My pleasure. Thanks for coming by.
Before we go, this piece of music you're hearing is inspired by a feature of the cosmos, nebulae. Those are interstellar clouds of dust and gas that sometimes birth new stars. Seattle composer Nan Avant created this piece as part of a project called Origins, Life and the Universe. She and seven other composers chose elements of space and astronomy as their muses, from the Big Bang to the Oort cloud. This piece is called Bijou. Sound Effect is a podcast that tells stories inspired by the place we live. It's produced at KNKX by Kevin Kniestad, Jennifer Wing, Posey Gruner, and me, Gabriel Spitzer. Our executive producer is Matt Martinez. I invite you to hit a few more stops on this Destination Moon pod crawl, marking the 50th anniversary of humanity's first moon landing. Our partner podcasts include Flight Deck, Radiotopia's The Truth, Geek Wire, and Stuff You Missed in History Class. Definitely take some time to check them out. Until next time, I'm Gabriel Spitzer. See you around.